At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
The legacy of slavery on Black wealth in America and the staffing shortage hits summer school. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdal. It's Monday, June 20th. Thanks for joining us on this Juneteenth federal holiday. And since it is a federal holiday, not much to report in terms of new economic data out today. So we'll start looking out ahead to some private industry numbers that are coming tomorrow. That's when the National Association of Realtors will release its latest data on sales of existing homes. The report will give us a closer look at how the nation's housing market is responding, with rising prices when it comes to renting and rising mortgage interest rates if you're trying to buy. Marketplace's Lily Jamali has this one.
The real cost of buying a house is skyrocketing, says Lawrence Yoon, chief economist at the National Association of Realtors.
The same home purchasing now versus 1 year ago, it would be up about 50% in monthly mortgage payment.
That's because home prices keep rising, so buyers need to get bigger mortgages. And mortgage rates are now around 6%, up from about 3% a year ago. Brad Dillman is chief economist at Cortland.
We're simply waiting for this to happen, where mortgage rates would go back up and reduce what I would describe as artificially strong activity in the floor purchase side.
The impact of the Federal Reserve's recent hike to its benchmark rate is still playing out. Lately, Redfin chief economist Daryl Fairweather has been using the term hibernation to describe this changing housing market.
Just in terms of like how little activity is happening right now for both buyers and sellers.
She says data show the number of pending sales is down 8% from last year, thanks to those higher mortgage rates. But she adds this is hardly a weak housing market.
Homes are selling just as quickly as ever. 50% of homes are still going under contract within 2 weeks.
Buyers are adapting to the fast pace of change, says Jonathan Miller, CEO of real estate appraiser Miller Samuel. But for sellers,
it's hard for them to capitulate to market conditions because they're sort of wedded to what the value is. And then all of a sudden, conditions change.
He says a market where bidding wars for homes have become the norm is just not sustainable. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
The markets were closed for the Juneteenth holiday, so we'll take a look at what's happening outside Wall Street when we do the numbers. Juneteenth commemorates when enslaved Black people in Texas found out, years late, about the Emancipation Proclamation, ending their enslavement at the hands of owners profiting off their unpaid labor. Yet the economic emancipation of Black Americans is an ongoing story. According to a recent study from the National Bureau of Economic Research, in 2019, for every dollar of wealth belonging to a white American, Black Americans had 17 cents. So why does this gap persist nearly 160 years after the end of slavery? Derek Hamilton is a professor of economics and urban policy and the founding director of the Institute on Race, Power, and Political Economy at the New School. And he's spent a lot of time thinking and writing about this. Dr. Hamilton, it's good to speak with you again.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
What was the state of Black wealth in the United States at the end of slavery?
Well, it was not zero, but the reality was that en masse, Black people served as a capital asset for a white landowning plantation class. But there were some emancipated Black individuals that did have some wealth. So it certainly wasn't zero, but it was grossly unequal.
In the decades immediately after slavery, what was the experience like for Black people trying to build wealth? What sorts of structural and legal issues did they run into?
Well, we had an evolution from a chattel slavery system to a sharecropping system, a system in which, as a result of not being owners of land, Black people were tenants of landowners. Despite political obstacles, despite literal violence, a surprising amount of agricultural land, farmland, had been accumulated since emancipation up to probably about the height around 1910 or so.
So can you talk a little bit about, you know, at the beginning, as well as what this era that you're talking about around 1910, what sorts of legal and structural obstacles were there to Black people trying to build wealth?
Well, part of the New Deal, part of the reaction to some of the conditions that were going on as a result of the Depression led to the United States Department of Agriculture trying to engage and promote farm ownership in a way to facilitate economic security for the American people. So although the legislation didn't say that Black people would be excluded, the implementation and management of these programs in a local Jim Crow context was done in a way that was very exclusionary and actually predatory. So, for example, there would be delays in when a loan might be approved. The recipient, if they were Black, would receive the loan after the harvest had already taken place. They weren't able to generate crops in order to go to market and generate resources, and they were vulnerable. And then we also know the history of just outright terror that was taking place. One famous incident is the Tulsa race riots, but well beyond Tulsa, there was a great deal of just violence and trying to force people to leave that actually owned land, and then that land became available for white people.
What's the legacy of not only the hundreds of years of enslavement, but then also these barriers after the institution ended?
The legacy is a country that devalued a people based on their identity. Whenever we think about political economy, it's not novel if we talk about an economy or if we talk about policy and politics. But what has been problematic in American history is that Black people themselves, that identity, when it came to transaction, if they engage with a white person, the identity itself put them at a disadvantage. And the reason it put them at a disadvantage, they have never had equal protection under the law the way a white person has.
Fast forward to the modern era, there are estimates that even if wealth accumulation was equal between Black Americans and white Americans over the last 160 years since slavery, it still wouldn't close the racial wealth gap. That neighbor study that I mentioned earlier estimated that even given equal conditions, it would still take 200 more years for the Black and white wealth gap to converge. Why are Black Americans still so far behind?
Well, the way that wealth is generated is it takes capital to generate additional capital. And what's more, capital grows in an exponential way. So if there's a gap to begin with, if you do nothing, a population will never catch up. But there's a silver lining in this story. When we think about wealth throughout American history, even for white people, it wasn't as if an asset-based white middle class simply emerged. It was public policy that helped a white middle class to emerge. Policies like the GI Bill or a debt-free college education. So the good news is that although this gap is dramatic and large, it can be redressed. We can change that history, that sordid history, and make sure that everybody has the financial wherewithal to really have the sovereignty that wealth brings.
Derek Hamilton is a professor of economics and urban policy and the founding director of the Institute on Race and Political Economy at the New School. Thanks so much and happy Juneteenth.
Thank you, Kimberly. Happy Juneteenth.
Educating students about Juneteenth and teaching in general is a tough job even in the best of circumstances. And now, after years of pandemic disruptions, students need more support and time in the classroom than ever, even in the summer. Trouble is, a lot of teachers who might have been willing to work in the summer in the past are tired and they want the time off this year, which means many school districts are having to adapt. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has more.
Kindergarten teacher Virginia Mosier arrives at work by 6:15 a.m. The kids arrive at 7:20, and then it's on.
It's like I'm on stage all day.
Because she not only talks, she sings some of her lessons.
And so, you know, for letters, you know, oh, the A goes ah, ah, ah. The A goes ah, ah, ah.
Mosier teaches at a public school in Las Vegas, and she used to instruct during the summer months, too. But she found it was more important to her to have the time off.
To relax, to be with my family, to spend some time at home. You know, I'm starting to do my house cleaning for the summer because I haven't dusted in forever because I've just been so busy and tired.
Mosier, who's been on the job for more than 20 years, wasn't tempted to teach this summer, even though her district's offering more money than it did before the pandemic. But for many teachers, especially younger ones, money's a useful recruitment tool. Marguerite Rosa is the director of the Edunomics Lab at Georgetown.
In any scenario, I think it's a matter of figuring out what the right incentives are.
Rosa points to one program in Indianapolis that's paying teachers up to $10,000 for 6 weeks of work.
If you have this nice, round, very clear number, like $10,000, you can start to see people weighing the decision, like, should I do that? I'll get $10,000.
In Niagara Falls, New York, Superintendent Mark Laurie isn't offering more money, but he is offering flexibility where teachers can work from home for some lessons. He says it's a lot simpler to get people through a virtual door than a real one.
It was really a heck of a lot easier than to get teachers to come in.
Laurie says school is no longer a September to June proposition, and with so many kids behind after years of being totally remote, they can't afford to take the summers off. In New York, I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Coming up,
the wage goes up and then the price goes up in tandem.
Yeah, usually how it goes. But first, let's do the numbers. U.S. markets are closed today for observance of the Juneteenth holiday. Later this week, Fed Chair Jerome Powell gives his semiannual testimony on monetary policy to members of Congress. We'll likely hear about inflation, interest rates, and the overall state of the U.S. economy. Overseas, the markets were open today. In Europe, natural gas prices jumped 6.1%. France's CAC 40 gained 0.6%. Germany's DAX gained 1%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Behind every successful business is a story. And some of them might surprise you, like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail, or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. In the push to update tech industry regulations, one of the big players is the Federal Trade Commission. It's been just over a year since Lina Khan took over as chair of that agency, and just over a month since the confirmation of a third Democrat to the five-member commission broke a long-standing deadlock at the agency. That means Khan has a fresh chance to move on her agenda. I recently spoke with Khan at her office here in Washington, D.C., and we talked about how data privacy plays a role in modern antitrust behavior and how the FTC is adapting its antitrust framework in response.
Some of the concerns are evergreen, right? I mean, the foundational concerns that led to some of the passage of some of the antitrust laws was around the control that a small number of railroads had come to capture over key arteries of commerce across the United States. Those are dynamics that we see today as well. When you have dominant firms, dominant intermediaries or middlemen that have come to capture control over key arteries of commerce or communication, that type of power really can do a lot of harm and lead to a lot of abuses. The FTC filed a lawsuit against Facebook. And in that lawsuit, we note that one of the harms that resulted from Facebook's illegal behavior was a loss in user privacy. And so that's an instance where, in as much as data privacy is a new, relatively newer type of harm that we're seeing in some of these newer markets, we're explaining to the courts why we think they should be taking that seriously.
And many of your, shall we say, unsupporters have said that this is not the role of the FTC, that data privacy legislation needs to come from Congress and that the FTC should stay out of it. Why do you think this is the agency's job?
Look, the FTC has been on the front lines of data privacy for decades. If firms are engaging in privacy violations that undermine or break the existing laws, we're going to enforce those laws.
We are experiencing record inflation. We just had Chair Powell raise interest rates again. In that body of work that you have accumulated before you even came here, you talk a lot about how consolidation in various industries contributes to higher prices. How much of a role do you think market consolidation is playing in the inflation that we're seeing now? And is there anything that the FTC can do about it?
Look, I think there's a very robust conversation around the various factors that are driving inflation. Some of those factors are tied to, you know, various disruptions that occurred spurred by the COVID pandemic. I think another factor that we have seen contribute is the way in which our supply chains have become much more brittle. So the ways in which consolidation and concentration has meant that in certain cases, we've put all our eggs in one basket. And as a result, when you have a particular type of shock or a particular type of disruption, that can lead to these cascading disruptions. One trend has been to really focus on short-term effects on consumer prices at the expense of potentially thinking about broader resiliency of the market. And so one thing that we're looking to do is think about resiliency. Just last year, the FTC sued to block a merger between NVIDIA and ARM, which involved key semiconductor equipment. We thought that type of lawsuit was really important to make sure that with these key inputs and key technologies, we have markets that are open, that are competitive, that are really positioning us to be resilient.
That gets to my next question, because semiconductors was on my list with industries like baby formula, meat, tampons, all these areas where we're having shortages with just a few companies operating in these spaces. Are you planning to do anything more like what you did with ARM and NVIDIA to try to either disperse the control in these industries or to prevent them from being more consolidated?
Just a few months ago, we initiated an inquiry into supply chain disruptions. One thing that we've heard about, especially from small businesses, from independent businesses, is that there might be economic discrimination happening in the marketplace that could be worsening or exacerbating these supply chain disruptions. We also, just a few weeks ago, launched an inquiry into the infant formula crisis to try to understand, how did we get here? What are the factors that contributed to this? And how do we make sure that for other essential life-saving goods and services that we are not replicating the situation where a single company or a single factory going offline can just lead to such disruption? We're also stepping back and doing a bigger reset. So both the FTC and the DOJ are currently revising what are known as the merger guidelines. This is basically our enforcement manual for how we identify unlawful deals. This is another area where incorporating more of those concerns around resiliency can also really equip us for the long term.
I saw that you're coming up on your fifth listening session for that, and I was looking at the comments because I do love the Federal Register, and I saw that you had like 5,000 comments, more than 1,000 of those publicly posted. Given all this feedback that you're receiving in the listening sessions, in the comments from stakeholders, how has that informed what you think the final new guidelines are going to look like?
Look, these listening sessions have been incredibly valuable. We've heard from market participants across the country, across sectors. So we heard from farmers, we heard from nurses, we heard from media producers, we heard from startups and entrepreneurs in the tech space. We're speaking to the ways in which consolidation can really close off markets, can make it difficult to enter, can make it difficult to compete on a level playing field. So really, it's led to a deeper appreciation for the real costs and the real harms that can emerge from these types of mergers and acquisitions, and really a mandate for us to make sure that our tools and our enforcement manual is fully reflecting that history and that experience.
Do you have a sense of when we'll see draft guidelines yet?
We're hoping that in the coming months, we'll be able to post draft guidelines and be able to get comments on those before we move forward with the final set.
Coming months, like 3 months, 6 months?
Within this calendar year.
Lina Khan is chair of the Federal Trade Commission. I spoke with Chair Khan the same day last week that the Federal Open Markets Committee announced it would raise interest rates by 75 basis points rather than the 0.5% increase the Fed was previously signaling. Central banks all over the world are tightening monetary policy, but as we mentioned last week, Japan is a bit of an outlier. The Bank of Japan is keeping its benchmark interest rate unchanged, -0.1%. The latest inflation number over there comes out later this week. Currently, Japan's inflation is at 2.5%. The Bank of Japan tried to boost prices for decades, driving stronger inflation through low, low interest rates and aiming for a weaker yen. Now, prices are rising, but most salaries haven't gone up in 30 years. The BBC's Mariko Oi sent this dispatch.
Down a quiet residential street, 30 minutes outside of central Tokyo, this 43-year-old family-run cooked food stall has been the go-to for housewives like my mother for decades. And for as long as we can remember, prices of its dishes displayed in a plastic cabinet right next to the road never went up until now.
We have to be creative. When vegetables are very expensive, we'll use more seaweed, for example.
Takako Imura and her husband run the stall with her family, and they're trying to avoid raising prices.
People's salaries haven't gone up, so we're still trying to absorb the higher costs as much as possible.
It's not the only business to raise prices for the first time in recent memory. You know, these corn snack sticks have been around since my childhood. Each stick has cost just 10 yen for more than 40 years. It's now 12 yen, or about a 2-cent raise. Not much at all, but here in Japan, raising prices is a big deal. It's almost a cultural taboo, so much so that the company which makes snacks like these had to launch an ad campaign explaining they had to raise prices because of higher ingredient costs. In a suburban mall on a rainy afternoon, I meet Nobuko Kobayashi from consultancy EY. Judging by the people strolling around the stalls of household wares, canned goods and bargain clothes, it's hard to tell that things have become more expensive. But in April this year, almost a decade after it was set by the central bank, Japan finally hit its inflation target of 2%. Much of it, however, was driven by the global rise in raw material and energy prices rather than consumer demand.
Because the wage is not going up, I think we could argue that this is a start of a bad inflation.
If people are not paid more to keep up with inflation, they are unlikely to go out shopping. Kobayashi says the government's aim was to create an environment where
people spend more, invest more, the wage goes up, and then the price goes up in tandem, moderately, not like hysterically.
One of Japan's biggest economic challenges for the last three decades has been deflation and its associated falling prices. Consumers came to expect low prices, so it was difficult for companies to raise them. The government spent large amounts on stimulus, such as public works, including bridges, freeways, and universities. The central bank also cut interest rates so low, borrowing was almost free. And still, there was little, if any, growth.
There is a huge pressure from society and the government of Japan to raise wages.
That's Takeshi Ninami, chief executive of Japan's largest beverage maker, Suntory, based in Tokyo. The company recently announced it's hiking prices for quite a few of its popular drinks starting in October. But what would it take for a business like his to raise wages?
We need to increase productivity. Of course, we are working on it. It's quite difficult for us to improve productivity all of a sudden.
Japan has grappled with boosting productivity for decades. With the ongoing war in Ukraine and the impact of COVID restrictions in China, global prices are likely to stay high. That means everyday consumers who have been shocked to see prices rise for the very first time in decades will feel even more of a squeeze. In Tokyo, I'm the BBC's Marie Goy for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today. With the new holiday comes those holiday flight delays, nearly 20,000 of them over the weekend, according to FlightAware. If you were driving, gas prices went down by a tiny bit. AAA has the national average at $4.98 a gallon. President Biden said today he's considering a federal gas tax holiday and hopes to have a decision on that by the end of the week. Suspending the federal gas tax could save drivers as much as 18.4 cents a gallon. We're out of time, so no moment of economic context today. Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kimberly Adams. We'll be back tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.